For our sermon this morning, we are continuing in our series of studies from the letter of Paul to the Ephesians. So I'm going to invite you to turn to page 183 in the New Testament section of the Bible in front of you. It's a great help to the preacher if you turn to the passage. Helps you to concentrate and to respond by your own vibrations. Helps me as I try and refer to one sentence and then another. We work together. It's a joint activity, the sermon. Ephesians chapter 6, verses 1 to 9, which we had read earlier, page 183. And our series is called One God, One People. And we are thinking about the style of the new society that God has called into being through the church. We focus here on verse 6 to begin with. Not in the way of eye service, as men pleasers, but as servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, rendering service with a good will as to the Lord, and not to men. One day I remember being rung up by the BBC next door, and they said, a certain person has died, and we happen to think that you may know how old he was. Could you tell us? So I said, I'm sorry to hear the news. But yes, I think I can probably find that out for you. I'll have to do a bit of research. Well, they said, if you could be in a hurry, because the program has already started, the news program. I said, very well. I said, leave it to me. And I put the phone down, and I started scrabbling through diaries, books, magazines, papers, struggling, and I couldn't find how old he was. I said to my wife, how old was he? She said, I don't know. I thought, I'll ring up somebody in Oxford. I rang up the person in Oxford and said, could you tell me how old was so-and-so? She said, leave it to me. He said, hold on a moment. And I heard him struggling through files, indexes, books, magazines. There was a tremendous flurry. Then suddenly he came back to me with a breathless voice and said, he was 72. I said, thank you very much indeed. I rang up the BBC and I said, just to tell you, he was 72. He said, thank you very much, put the phone down. So I thought, I'll listen to the program as it goes out, see what they say. And they made the bald comment, so-and-so has died, he was aged 72. I thought, is that all? After all my work? I wanted somehow, illogically, for them to make more of a flourish of the knowledge that I'd given them. I wanted them to say something like, after considerable research on the part of our friends, Richard Buse, etc., etc. But it wasn't to be. I'd done my bit. They were grateful. No one was to know. It's funny, isn't it? We like to have recognition of the things that we do. We like for people to say, oh, yes, it was so-and-so who did that. No. When we give service, for whom are we doing it? And why? That's what stabs us out of this passage this morning. It's this knowledge that we are not unseen by God, that the service we give is for Christ, and it's that that lifts Christian behavior out of the character of dull, dry morality and gives it a revolutionary cutting edge, creating an ethic that at certain points in history has had society gasping. This practical section of the letter to the Ephesians, far from being tagged on as an afterthought, has to be seen as a direct outworking of the mighty truths that have glowed like alpine peaks in the sunshine of the New Testament revelation. If we really are chosen in Jesus Christ and enlightened by him, as chapter 1 tells us, if we really have been raised and reconciled by him, as we learn from chapter 2, if we really are empowered and united by him, exchanging the old life for the new, as chapters 3 and 4 thunder out, then an ethical revolution must follow. We will walk as children of light, to quote chapter 5, verse 8. We should be spirit-filled men and women, and this should be reflected in our lifestyle, our relationships, in the creation of Christian marriages, as we heard last week. So today we come to, and look at the passage, Children and parents, verse 1. Fathers, verse 4. Slaves, verse 5. And masters, verse 9. And in each instance, something in the nature of a revolution was required if Christian living was to have any kind of distinctiveness about it. Do we realize what values dominated life in the Roman Empire in the first century? If the position of women needed to be elevated by the power of Jesus Christ, as we were reminded last week, so did the place of children. In Roman society, a son could never come of age, truly, while his father was still alive. However high he rose, he still remained within his father's absolute power. Family life, as Christians know it today, was very nearly impossible, as our church historians tell us. And it was up to the church to provide a new model. When we hear today of babies being left in carrier bags on some step somewhere, it hits the headlines on the TV screens. It happened every day in first century society. It was regular. People would write letters to each other and they'd say, oh, by the way, if the baby is born a boy, that's lovely. If it's a girl, leave it. It's all right. Forget it. Toss it out. It's part of the society. And slaves? It has been computed, writes William Barclay, that in the Roman Empire there were 60 million slaves. And what was a slave? A slave was described in Roman law as instrumentum vocale, a tool that can speak. Of course, there were good owners as well as bad, but the masters had absolute power of life and death over another human being, if that human being was a slave. The Roman Empire existed and ran itself on the whole framework of slavery. Millions of people never did a stroke of work. The slaves did the lot. So how was the Christian revolution to be worked out in such a society? Where was its impetus, its power, its sparkle to come from? Let's look first at the perspective of heaven. The perspective of heaven. The perspective of heaven that was to dominate and transform the duty of a Christian man or woman and give it wings. Look at chapter 6, would you? And verse 1. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. An admirable sentiment, of course, but rather boldly expressed. This is right. Look on at verse 5. Slaves, be obedient to those who are your earthly masters with fear and trembling. Look at verse 9. Masters, do the same to them and forbear threatening, knowing that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven. Now, if Christian living was simply a succession of bare commands, obey your parents because that's right, all the sparkle and originality would have been stripped away from us. But our lives, says the apostle, are to be lived on two levels. There's the earthly dimension of all these human relationships that have got to be worked out, but also the heavenly. So again, look at verse 5. Slaves, be obedient to those who are your earthly masters with fear and trembling, in singleness of heart, as to Christ, not in the way of eye service as men pleases, but as servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, rendering service with a good will as to the Lord, and not to men. Does it help to read that? Verse 9 has the same sort of idea. Masters, you've got your responsibilities for bear threatening, knowing that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven. You are not unwatched. There is somebody in charge of you both. So that there is this heavenly perspective that honestly ought to shape all these relationships and have an effect upon them. It's there for the children too, verse 1. Obey your parents in the Lord. There's a vertical aspect there, in the Lord. Their obedience is to be understood in the Christian relationship. And perhaps verse 2, with its reminder of the fifth commandment, strengthens this idea with those words there in brackets. This is the first commandment with a promise, it says. And the commentators vary as to how we should interpret those words. Perhaps we are to understand that commandment as what Francis Fuchs calls a primary commandment, one of prior importance. And certainly when we think about it, boys and girls, I can see one or two of you here. You think about it. You knew the law of your parents before you ever knew the law of God. Isn't that right? When your mom and dad said to you, "You should do this, please." You knew that, the law of theirs, long before you had really understood what the law of God was. And Proverbs chapter 23, verse 22 puts it well. Listen to your father. Without him you would not exist. When your mother is old, show her your appreciation. So the moral is that when you lose your relationship with your parents, you have lost in a great degree your moorings. Let's not take our parents for granted, if they are still alive. Have you thought about it, that the fifth commandment there is the only commandment that you will not be able to keep all your life? There will be a moment when our parents have left this earth, and we can't keep that commandment anymore. So maybe Mothering Sunday is a good day to remind us about that family relationship. Not to take them for granted. And to keep in touch with the telephone. I say it to myself. To write those letters. To ask for advice and to receive it from them. And to make the most of these precious people who have made it possible for us to be alive at all. I knew of a boy of 13 who had no moorings at all, it seemed. He committed burglary after burglary at the age of 13, was apprehended. Finally, I, as a minister, was asked to go and visit him, and I did. And it transpired that he did not know who his father was. There were many men in his life, but they all went by the name of Uncle. Which one of them was his father, he never knew. And his mother said, "Oh, he doesn't worry about that." It's hard to obey one's relatives. We have to work at it. Some of us who are younger, and we still know what it is to be rather under the domination of an older person, we have to work at it. Just as we were being reminded about marriage last week. In our own family, in earlier days, the saying went round, "A lie to Auntie Katie is not a lie." Well, we still have to work at it. It's the Christian aspect, the heavenly perspective, that makes the earthly duty at least a possibility. It's the same with the father's duty in verse 4. It is to God, to the Lord, for his sake, that discipline and instruction is to be given. But without provocation, the fathers are reminded. Without winding your children up in the giving of the instruction and in the setting of the example. A mother once told a clergyman, who was actually a bishop, that she wouldn't give any religious instruction to her children until they'd reached the years of discretion, as she put it. And the bishop replied, "Well, if you don't teach them, the devil will." You might as well let a garden grow by itself with the weeds and nettles all together everywhere, and then say at the end, I was just waiting for it to grow to the years of discretion. Let the roses plant themselves. It's the perspective of God, of Christ, of heaven, that makes it possible for us to manage as parents and as children. And we have to hold on to that. The disobedience to parents is a symptom of the Gentile evil world. Romans 1 verse 30 says so, it is repeated in 2 Timothy chapter 3 verse 2, that in evil days of decline, one of the great symptoms is disobedience to parents. So there is a marriage, there is a bond between the sacred and the secular, between the horizontal and the vertical. Obey your parents, but in the Lord. And then fathers, you do what is right. Masters, you do what is right for the slaves. But remember, you're watched by somebody. Slaves, you're serving your masters. But you're doing so with an eye to the Lord, not to what your masters even think about it. There's a bond between the sacred and the secular. I do think that verses 5 to 7 put it so well there. Rendering service with a good will. Very hard to do in Roman society when you're just an instrument that can speak. If you're just that, how can you do that with a good will? Only if there's the other dimension of heaven and of God and of Christ motivating you as a Christian slave. Then they could say, I can do it. With his grace and with his help, I'll do it. Can we take that in? This has so much to do, this marriage of the sacred and the secular, with what we call the Protestant work ethic. At one stage in history, we had divorced the sacred from the secular. In the Middle Ages, if you had any paintings of quality, they would turn out to be religious paintings, again and again. And the secular, well, that was left to itself. Then came the Reformation, and then people began to discover that wonderful truth, that everyday, ordinary things are important to God. And so the artist began painting lovely Dutch interiors of kitchens and things like that. It was important. It expressed, really, that philosophy very well with those words of George Herbert, a servant with this clause makes drudgery divine, who sweeps a room as for thy laws, makes that and the action fine. That is the ethic. That we may be given something to do in life that is actually very dull. And the slaves, perhaps, are to set us the example and give us the model. They were required to do what they had to do with an eye to God, not to men. And it was then regarded as being possible to achieve. The heavenly perspective enabled those beaten down slaves of the Roman Empire to outperform their masters. The frescoes in the early catacombs of Rome demonstrated the different outlook that belonged to the Christian slaves. And social distinctions were absolutely effaced in those tombs of the early Christians. Labor became honored, as it was not honored, really, in the Roman Empire. And then the master, verse 9, he had to have his outlook changed with that knowledge that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven. And there was given the reminder to those early Christians that there is neither Jew nor Greek, neither slave nor free. You're all one in Jesus Christ. And those words contained a time bomb, ticking away quietly there in the heart of the Roman Empire. Its time would come when the whole edifice would cave in. 60 million slaves, that would be no more one day. And it was the perspective of heaven that could make it possible at all. The perspective of heaven. Secondly, the promise of rewards. That also makes the Christian revolution possible. The promise of rewards. Look at verse 3. Here's the word to these children, that you should honor your father and your mother. Verse 3, that it may be well with you, and you may live long on the earth. No, that's not an individual promise. It's not a promise to the individual saying, if you obey your parents, you will have prosperity, long life, all those things that we crave. It's a national promise. It is a national promise to Israel, saying, if you have that value at the center of your society, of honoring of parents and the upholding of family life, you will find you're given longevity in the nation. You will find that element of continuity, stability, harmony, all those things that a nation really longs for, if you have that principle at your center. It's a national promise. So there's a reward there. If we can put those things first and set those examples, it will bear rich dividends. Verse 8 also speaks of rewards, knowing that whatever good anyone does, he will receive the same again from the Lord, whether he is a slave or free. On either side of that terrible divide of slaves and masters, if they put God first and were able to serve him for his own sake, they would find that there would be a reward. What is the reward? It's difficult to pinpoint it. I must be talking to somebody here with a dull job. I must be. Somebody here, you cannot stick your job. It may be that we have to put God to the test on this and see if we can't look at it again, that job of ours, in fresh eyes. I've only once had a dull job, and it was cripplingly dull, but only for a short time. I spent 1 year in Peak Freen's biscuit factory, and I was on the factory floor there as a factory hand, shoveling sugar through a chute, through a sieve, and the sieve was shaking all the time. So I put it through the sieve, the sugar would then go down to the bottom floor. Then, because I was rather faster than the gentleman who was underneath, they took him away and put him on another job and said, "Bews, you can do the whole lot. Shovel the thing through, run like a hare down the stairs just in time to collect the sack full of sugar, wheel it away, tie it up, put it in a place, go up the stairs again and repeat the whole process." All the way through the day, and I was doing overtime, so I got there at 6 o'clock in the morning and went straight through till about 6 o'clock at night. Very dull. Of course, I knew it was only for a year. So I'd set myself little competitions. I would see if I could beat my record and things like that. Then, of course, I found I was in trouble with the union, so I had to be careful, tactful. I did find that I grew as a person in that year. Gained a little bit, only a tiny bit, of understanding of my workmates. And some of them had done that for 40 years. It is a test. Are there rewards? I believe there are rewards. But if we can do something with God at the center of it, who sweeps the room as for thy laws, makes that and the action fine, if we can do with it from that perspective, we're likely to grow as people and actually find even some strange satisfaction in the things we're doing because we're doing it for him, not for men. The perspective, the promise. What gives impetus and thrust to the Christian revolution? It's those two things, the perspective of heaven, the promise of rewards. But I want to end off with this last thought. The pacemakers also give the impetus to us, the pacemakers of history. Who are these pacemakers? They're around. See, there's no more testing environment than the laboratory of the Roman Empire. I think that was the ultimate for slaves and masters. What are they to do? Supposing you've been a slave, trapped into a system, sold at birth, perhaps as an unwanted baby, taken over by a master who sold you from person to person, and if you did wrong, or dropped the crockery, you could have your eyes taken out. Anything could happen to you. Or sold again. Do you overthrow the system? Sometimes people have criticized Paul and said to him, why didn't he say to those slaves, overthrow the system, defy your masters, lose your shackles, give them the heave-ho. That would perhaps have been to reduce Christ to a mere Spartacus or Karl Marx. There was a more radical way still, to treat the barriers as though they didn't exist at all. And to show in the Christian church that it could be done. Slaves or free, there's no distinction. You're all one, says Paul. Prove it now in the Christian family. Let us see that it can be done. And Paul's letter, therefore, to Philemon, and verse 16, referring to the runaway slave Onesimus, who'd been a bad boy. He could have been put to death for what he did. But Paul says to Philemon, he's to be seen now, no longer as a slave, and I'm quoting, but more than a slave, as a beloved brother. That is more radical than saying, let's overthrow the system. Because in those words is a time bomb quietly ticking away until the moment comes when the idea explodes the whole system and it begins to cave in. All the way through history we've had these pacemakers. William Wilberforce was one of them, of course you'll remember. And 4 days before John Wesley died, he wrote his last letter to William Wilberforce, the great campaigner against slavery, February 24th, 1791. He said this, his last letter, unless God has raised you up for this very thing, you will be worn out by the opposition of men and devils. But if God is with you, who can be against you? Oh, be not weary in well-doing. Go on in the name of God and in the power of his might, till even American slavery, the vilest that ever saw the sun, shall vanish away before it. He was a pacemaker, and there are others too. Those Christians who started the trades union movement, and it's good that we had reading our lesson this morning, the Labour spokesman for foreign affairs, because there was a wonderful tie-up between the Methodists and those early Labour leaders. And between them both, they got the trades union movement started. The Roman Empire would never have stood for a trades union movement, or a guild, or anything like that. The thing would have been stamped out. And even until a century or so ago in this country, a trade union would have been regarded as illegal. Who are these pacemakers? They're people we can derive inspiration from and say, if they could do it, even in the Roman Empire, then I can also learn to live with my own frustrations and difficulties and even find a reward in it, as long as I'm doing it for God. We have to take them seriously. Who are the pacemakers that have been in your life and set you an example of inspiration and hope and courage? Because they're around, all right. I can think of a lady who had given all her life, all the best years of her life, to looking after her invalid mother. And you might have said, if you were a cynic, she had been trapped into it, waste of her energies. Now her mother finally, as a very old lady, dies, and she is left as a growing old person. Is it all gone to nothing? Not if we did it for God. If we do it for God, it is possible to find a reward in that. The reward is God himself and more of Jesus Christ. Or somebody who's gone through personal catastrophe. There are some of us, I'm sure, who are in that. And then to emerge progressively, victoriously, steadily, as a person of God-like character and Christian disposition, this is the true revolution that can upset the status quo of even 60 million slaves in a difficult situation. The perspectives, the promises, the pacemakers. We can be a pacemaker. Maybe that's what we learn from these despised, trodden down children and slaves. We can learn to live in a situation and then to overcome. Doing our service, not for the people who can see what we're doing, but for God. Let's pray. Rendering service with a good will. Dear Lord, we find that impossible without yourself at the center of life. Help us carefully with the Holy Spirit's assistance to apply what we have been thinking about from this practical passage of Ephesians. Help us to apply it in our own situations and environment with triumph and confidence for your name's sake. Amen.